Okay, Bill, we're going to talk about Schaefer. You obviously know Schaefer. You've recently written a book about Schaefer. So I'm interested in knowing how and when you were introduced to Schaefer, and were you a Christian at the time?
Sure. Well, it was in 1964. I was a sophomore at Harvard University, and in one of my classes, there was an instructor named Harold O.J. Brown, who spoke in the class as a believer, even though he made it very natural. I was not a believer. I was, I guess you'd call it a seeker, very taken with what Professor Brown was saying, because he compared the different worldviews we were looking at to the Christian worldview, and I'd never heard anything remotely like this. I grew up in a wonderful family, but we weren't, evangelical by any stretch. So he and I got to be friends. He suggested, I was going over to Europe that summer anyway with my brother, and he said, you would really enjoy meeting a friend of mine, Francis A. Schaefer. He didn't say anything about him. He just said he has similar beliefs to mine, and he's a very articulate spokesman for them. So to make a long story short, we went to Europe, and about halfway through the summer, my brother wanted to go to the States, and I wanted to stay for a while, so I thought I'd go look up Joe Brown's good friend, Francis Schaefer. So I called him, and Mrs. Schaefer actually came on the phone and urged me to stay for the weekend, which was kind of unusual, but it was the 60s, and I was up for anything. And so I put my backpack on my back, took the train down to Lausanne, and then to Eglin, and then up the little cog railway in those days, and then finally the mail bus, and ended up in this little village in the middle of the Swiss Alps named Wemu. And in those days, now it's full of traffic and people going up to Wilau, but in those days it was really quiet. And so I got to this community, and almost immediately Francis Schaefer came over to greet me, and then we had a discussion that night, and then the next morning he spoke to me, and somewhere in that conversation, I just knew it was all true, and so I gave myself to the Lord, and stayed there for many weeks, and became quite good friends with both Fran and Edith Schaefer, and as you say, I've written about him, and I use his materials all the time in my own work, so he was my first great mentor, and I owe him so much. So that's how it all happened.
Now, Harold O.J. Brown had invited Schaefer to Harvard, I believe, to speak, did he not, somewhere around that time?
So the same year, a little later in the year, Harold Brown started a lecture series called CCTL, and we had quite a few speakers. He had some funding for it. We had Doyevird, we had Florovsky, we had Van Til, and we had Schaefer twice. And he came, and we spent a lot of time together, and he packed out Lowell Lecture Hall, which is one of Harvard's classrooms. It's more than a classroom, it's a big auditorium. And it was absolutely riveting stuff. I brought all my friends who, none of whom were believers, and most of whom were a bit astonished at what had happened to me. And they loved it, and he was just remarkable. So, yeah, you're right. And Joe Brown, he kept up with Francis Schaefer. He became the theological secretary of IFEF, mm-hmm. and they moved him to Lausanne. So he was over in Switzerland and was able to stay in touch with the Schaefers from there.
I have, there is a letter in the archives in which it's a correspondence between Schaefer and Brown, in which you were mentioned.
Oh, my.
And in which Schaefer is reporting to Brown that how pleased he is with your spiritual progress.
Isn't that amazing? I was unaware of that. It doesn't surprise me that they talked about me, because when I got to La Brea, it would seem that somehow the Schaefers knew I might be coming, but I've never heard of that correspondence. And as I told you, I'm looking forward to the day when I can spend a few days or even weeks down in the archives and sort of dig up some of this stuff.
Well, it's I won't talk about that, but you're certainly welcome. My question here is, all right, so Schaefer comes in 1964, so we're now just sort of starting into the Cultural Revolution here in this country, and I'm sure it was further advanced on university campuses at that time. What is it you think that Schaefer brought to that time, that context, that people would pack out the hall to come listen to Francis Schaefer?
Well, he brought answers for the turmoil and chaos that a lot of us as students were experiencing. It was the time of nuclear threats. The Cold War was raging. There had been, Cuban Missile Crisis. A lot of people in college had discovered hallucinatory drugs. There was the civil rights upheavals. And so it was a time of turmoil. And what he brought was a framework within which to understand these things. He believed that they were the result of a rather baseless response to the victory of the Second World War by a generation that was well-intentioned but not fully aware of the need for moral absolutes. So he also spoke in ways that were so attractive to us in college because his illustrations were from, Bergman movies and John Cage's compositions and the existentialist philosophers that were in the air. And so he spoke into our world. He was fully conversant with so many of the trends in the arts, in theology and philosophy, and he brought those illustrations. And then the fundamental thing is that he was committed to the Christian worldview. He was committed to the authority of Scripture. I mean, he didn't preach directly on that always to these audiences, but it was quite obvious that the Bible had the basic answers for the questions that we all have. In fact, he had come to faith himself in large part by picking up a Bible and being convinced by it. So he had that foundation. So, and then finally, he was a very gracious and, I would say, winsome individual. He made the gospel attractive. He was very human, and he was he had time for people, and he spent hours and hours with, me and my friends. And, that part of his ministry was just as important, I think, his graciousness, as the commitment to truth in his speech. So all of that gave him a tremendous platform that many of us responded to.
What were you studying at Harvard?
So my subject was music. Mm-hmm. I was on my way to becoming a a professional musicologist.
Mm-hmm.
So not so much a performer. I do a bit of that, but a research scholar in various fields of musicology. And Harvard had a first-rate department, and we were a small department, so I had contact, personal contact with all of the professors, and I wrote my senior thesis on a composer named Anton von Webern, and my thesis director was one of America's prominent composers, a guy named Leon Kirshner. So that's what I thought I was doing until I began to think I would like to know a lot more about my newfound faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the decision as I graduated to go to seminary and put off the music thing. So I did, and then that changed a lot of things for me. I became a teacher, and I've been in and out of teaching theology for 45 years.
When Schaefer was at Harvard, you say students came. Did any of the profs attend?
Oh, just a few that I can remember. I mean, there were one or two believing professors, and there were maybe one or two that came out of curiosity. But he was not how to say this. He was not a scholar in the traditional sense. And so I would think some of the professors who would have wanted, you know, more footnoting and more careful parsing of issues might have found him pretty informal. And I don't know this for sure, but I know that there were academics that hesitated from some of his conclusions and his methods, just because that's not the way that they operated. So, yeah, I think a few were there, but not very many.
And, of course, this would have been prior to any publication, I mean, any serious publication, right? I mean, I think The
right.
God Who Is There comes out in 1968.
Yep.
Now, he had published some other things, but they would have only been known within within a Christian community.
Right. He published a few articles, and he had the 25 basic Bible studies. But the major thing came when he put out The God Who Was There and also Escape from Reason.
Mm-hmm.
And those books were wonderful because they carried his voice. You know, they were literally a result of his lectures that he wrote down, and but it had a mixed reception. It had a very positive reception in many circles, and Jim Sire and InterVarsity Press did a great job of editing him and getting the books into publication shape. But there were those Christians, especially, who thought his approach was just not as careful and as professional as they wanted. As you probably know, several critical books came out responding to him. One of the most thoughtful was edited by a fellow named Rooksager, and it had articles by various Christians on Schaefer's view of this and that, music, politics, philosophy, and, you know, many of them gave him a C+ or a B-. And if you want to go that route, of course you could find gaps, and he wasn't a professional scholar, so you could do that, but I've read those critiques pretty carefully, and I think they often miss two things. One is they miss some of the insights he really did have, which, despite the informality, are good, needing to be proved a bit more. But, you know, he had a good nose for what was going on. And the second is they miss the brilliance, the genius of his confidence in a Christian vision of life for a generation that that was pretty lost at sea on a lot of that. So yeah, those books were legitimate, and they make you think. And I've done some critical thinking about Schaefer myself, but as I say, they sometimes miss what he could do and his style, which was explosive and very very percussive.
Well, you've talked to me about the general ideas, but were there any specific things that you heard from Schaefer that attracted you to the Christian faith?
Well, the very first weekend I was there, they had this discussion group. They called it that. It was basically someone asked a question and he would answer for 15, 20 minutes. And the subject that night, you know, I'll never forget it. It was prayer. And I'd never thought about prayer. I mean, I went to a boarding school, which had, it was an Episcopal school, so we had a liturgy. So I knew what prayer was. And I knew a number of prayers from the prayer book. But this was different. This was about prayer as a lifeline between us and God. And he gave a lot of illustrations about answered prayers, which, again, I'd never heard anything remotely like this because I didn't grow up in those circles. And so that one of the things that made an impact on me was the reality of the spiritual life that was believed and practiced. You know, we had prayer all over the place. There was a day of prayer every week. Meals were times of deep fellowship and conversation, and we took walks after the meals. And so there was that remarkable spirituality of the community. Now, of course, some of the answers also were striking. A theme that came up all the time was the dignity of humankind, the significance of history, things that I've seen confirmed in my theological studies. We have the image of God, and we have common grace, which is an affirmation of the significance of human decision and so forth. But I didn't know these theological words, but the concepts were life-changing because it gave an answer to some of the questions we were all facing about who is the human being? What is significance? What is meaning? You know, why are people on drugs? Why do they object to the Vietnam War? What's the basis? And he gave, without going into policy or anything like that, he gave the contours of answers, moral and theological answers to these deep questions that everyone was asking. So, I mean, there are lots of other things. He also, as a musician, I loved LaBrie's emphasis at the time, I guess it still is, on the arts. There was a retired opera singer there that became a very close friend named Jane Stewart Smith, and she gave lectures on, music with a Christian understanding. Schaefer's partner and best friend was a man named Hans Ruckmacher, who, in addition to being an art historian, was also one of the European experts on early American jazz. He had fallen in love with his music, and he had written extensively on it. And so he would come to LaBrie, and he would teach us about the relationship of jazz music to the Christian gospel as experienced by African-American people. And as I was a jazz musician, this was just riveting stuff. And so there were lots and lots of connections which made it the right timing and the right atmosphere for this young man. I was only 19 at the time, and I, you know, I just responded to all this like a sponge.
Did you then, after that, other times that you met with Schaefer, did you ever live at Le Brie for any length of time other than that first visit?
So, yes, I did. Curiously, providentially, our family moved to Geneva that very summer. My dad was in the telecommunications business, and his company moved him to the European headquarters in Geneva. So that was home for 20 years or so. And, of course, every time I went home, I hightailed it up to Le Brie and stayed there, you know, for days and weeks and weeks. My wife, who went up to Le Brie a year later and became a deep believer there, she ended up living at Le Brie for a year and a half. And not only did she help out in Waymo, but they sent her to London to help with the fledgling British Le Brie. It was spearheaded by Ranald and Susan McCauley, who were very close friends to this day. So we both spent a lot of time at Le Brie, as well as when the Schaefers would come to America, we would, of course, track them down and spend time with them. And then, to make a very long story short, I ended up teaching theology in a Reformed seminary at Aix-en-Provence. And when I got the job in 79, the Schaefers were still alive. They'd moved up the mountain to another little village, but my wife and I went up there pretty often to visit or give talks, or and we always enjoyed hanging out with the Schaefers. So I kind of kept up with him right through close to the end. We weren't with him at the very end, but we were very, you know, close. And I felt like this was not just a spiritual father, but really a dear friend, and Edith as well. I think anyone who knows Le Brie would have to say The one of the secrets of the atmosphere there, maybe the great secret, was Edith and her, you know, remarkable homemaking ability, her prayer life, her Bible studies, her, you know, just her conversations into the wee hours. So, you know, we both felt very close to both of them. I dedicated a book to her in gratitude. So, remarkable couple, and we did stay, you know, short of being workers. They asked us if we would like to come over and do that, and we thought about it, and we decided probably not with two small children. But short of that, we stayed as close to them as you can.
So, in all of this, what features of Schaefer? Now I'm speaking just personally, as you interacted with Schaefer, you've talked about his tremendous emphasis on prayer. I'm told that he would stop even in the middle of an airport and pray. But aside from that, what are some of the outstanding features of this man that I don't say attracted you to him necessarily, but you think were very important to his overall ministry?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the favorite Le Brie words is reality.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, as you know, Dr. Schaefer in the early 50s experienced a very troubling spiritual crisis. He had been part of a movement that had separated from a lot of other branches of the Presbyterian Church, and he defended the truth of this, of their views, the general truths of the Christian faith, but also particulars such as the millennial issue and some of the issues about the Christian liberties. And he came to a place where he realized that it was dry and not loving. And he decided to revisit his whole commitment to Christ. And, you know, sometimes this is called the hayloft experience, because he paced up and down. They had this chalet up in, not Waymo yet, but another Swiss village before they got to Waymo. And he basically started from scratch and came out a few months later, I'm sure to the great relief of the long-suffering and patient Edith, believing that it was true, but also that they had not practiced the love that needed to be along with the truth. And so he taught about this, but he also exhibited this tremendous love and reality. He was just a very authentic person. He will tell you that Labrie was the result not so much of a philosophical view, because he had had those, but of his rediscovery of true spirituality. So that's one of the things that you couldn't miss. He was a authentically, powerfully spiritual person who really practiced the reality that he preached about. I mean, there were other things as well. He addressed certain issues that no one was, at least that I know of, few, if any, evangelicals were addressing at the time. One of them is pollution. Mm-hmm. He had he wrote a book on pollution and the death of man, which was quite prescient. And I remember in that book he addressed the two sort of opposite errors about ecology. One is we can fix it all with technology. You know, this is sort of the optimist error. We've gotten ourselves into a mess, but with our savvy, we can make it right. And that, he believed, was profoundly unbiblical. The other one was the more pantheistic error. You know, if more people would hug trees and stop producing things that pollute, you know, we would all be better off. And he cordially disagreed with that view as well. And he came out with the more proper biblical view of the cultural mandate, gentle lordship over God's world. There were other issues as well. He was interested in politics. He was interested. He got later than when I had met him, but we still were in touch. He got very involved with the pro-life movement, and because that was a direct fruit of his view of the dignity of the human being. And he, as you know, he collaborated with C. Everett Koop, who was the Surgeon General under Ronald Reagan, on a film and a book about issues of infanticide and euthanasia and abortion and so forth. And some people thought he was overreacting, that he was kind of becoming right-wing. But actually, I think history has proven him quite insightful on those things, because we're in a time now when some of those things are practiced and admitted more than they ever were even in his day. So those were some other issues that that drew me to them, just his prophetic ability to take on a world issue and put it into his framework. Those were things that just made him an unusual apologist for, you know, the Christian position. Kind of unpredictable, you know. Sometimes I think evangelicals, we are awfully predictable people, and so, you know, people, they don't listen to us because they know what we're going to say. And Schaefer would keep you off balance. He would say, you know, things that were alarming, not untrue, but just it would catch you off guard. And so that was part of his attraction to our generation as well. Barb and I have often reflected on, you know, the human factors. It would seem to us that we would not have responded to Billy Graham and his campaigns. And I love Billy Graham, and I you know, I love listening to him, and I've been to a lot of his campaigns. But at that age, you know, at time of lostness, I it just wasn't the kind of thing that would have drawn me. Now, God can do anything, but that's, it just seemed to us. But so, and yet Francis Schaefer, you know, wearing his climbing, mountain climbing outfit and growing his hair long. And, you know, this was our way to become countercultural. That was to become evangelical Christian. You know, you know, all of my generation struggled to be real and countercultural. And our rebellion against the culture was to become Christians. And he's the kind of person that would have made that possible, I think, more than a Billy Graham, who, you know, wonderful, wonderful man, and but an establishment kind of figure who he'd go out and play golf with him. It just wasn't our style, and God uses all kinds of things.
So this brings me to a question. By the way, I've interviewed Jane Stuart Smith. A wonderful interview with her, because she's gone home to be with the Lord now, but before that, and somebody who had greatly influenced, as you and so many others, by Schaefer, but first probably influenced, or maybe I should say attracted, more by his person, by how LaBrie was run, how the family was run, his authentic relationship with humanity, that just seemed to be so attractive to people. And maybe it's because that's what, at least in the 60s, the 70s, people were looking for, some kind of authenticity. The church had not seemed to give too much of it.
Yeah, that's. I think that's exactly right. On the other hand, we met people at LaBrie who had been a bit messed up by the fundamentalist background they came from, and ended up being quite critical of the church. And I don't think Schaefer himself meant to give this impression, but it was an impression you could pick up from being there, that the church had gone bourgeois and middle class, and Barb and I never felt that, because we didn't come from a church background. We loved the church. Yeah, they were middle class, and the music wasn't very good, and all, but we didn't get into that critical spirit. And I think LaBrie today is helping more people from that messed up fundamentalist background than they are people who are lost philosophically and seeking and so forth. I don't say there's none of them. Of course, there are plenty. But the people that seem to come are those who have this, who struggled because of a legalistic background or a overly doctrinaire church, and when I get to LaBrie, they're liberated, because it's fine to talk about the arts and to have a Christian view of pollution, and you know, there's a kind of a wonderful freedom and safety to talk about those things. The danger is seeing that freedom to then become very bitter against the background, and not see the good in what was there, which Schaefer would have seen. But you know, you can somehow pick that up if you're not listening carefully.
Well, tell me, There have been recently, your book, Cola Derriere, earlier, Brian Fallis, and before that there have been other books, but these are relatively recent books. I think, what, your book came out, what, 2-3 years ago?
Yeah.
So what do you think the status is in terms of let's just start with the evangelical and their attitude towards Schaefer. Is it that they simply, he has no name recognition? Is it that they have read some Schaefer and thought it's not applicable for today? How would you evaluate Schaefer in light of the, even the young evangelical today and their response to or annoyance with Schaefer?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a hard one because the sociology of this is complex. On the one hand, he's coming back all the time in some circles. We were down in Houston, and there at Houston Baptist, there's a number of really gifted philosophy professors and others who just love Francis Schaefer. So you find his name coming back, you know, he's revived. Publishers such as Crossway have kept him alive in all kinds of wonderful ways. But then on the other hand, he's definitely a voice from the mid-20th century. You know, I recently looked at parts of his film, How Shall We Then Live? Well, I mean, it was an amazing film when it came out. Nothing was quite like it, but it definitely has a sort of Cold War feeling to it. And his analysis of the line of despair and how irrationality is the major error of the time, and that theology follows, you know, art and philosophy and so on. Those seem a little bit quaint. And so people just could easily say, well, he was important in the day, and now, you know, we need something else. So I'd say all of that is true. And I'm really glad for, you know, Brian Fallis and Colin and the work that they're doing in Cambridge at that Christian Heritage work. Mm-hmm. Because it's taking the things that need to be remembered and building on them and deepening them. Susan McCauley's work on education, or some of Johnny Walford's work on the arts, or others, they're taking some of his ideas and working with them and, you know, revising them in some cases, but also deepening them and applying them, you know, as he would have wanted. Somebody like Oz Guinness, you know, I think he's just perhaps the greatest contemporary apologist. And he will tell you that he owes a lot of his insight to Francis Schaefer. His other mentor is Peter Berger, the sociologist, but Francis Schaefer is the one whose passion for truth and for people got him galvanized and moving in that direction. So yeah, I think the answer to your question is a complex one. I'm expecting more revivals to come up, and you know, they will, but they're increasingly, I think people will be thinking he was a very important voice for the 60s and 70s, and now you take what you should, but you build on the parts that are enduring and not, you know, his analysis of where things were going during the Cold War.
Yes, I remember reading in your book, I believe, where you said, or at some point, it might have been a quote somewhere, that at Schaefer's life and even at his death, you thought that, well, he would certainly have a place for a while, but that now you're convinced that he has a permanent place as a luminary in the evangelical world. Do you still think that?
I do, Bruce. I think he's a luminary. He's a model. He's an example. And in some cases, he's just so right on in his analysis. I think that part of him, will endure. Now it's up to us in the next generation to keep the flame alive and apply things as we see them. To mention Oz Guinness again, I think one of the great things that he did, he was at Labrie for quite a while, and then he felt that he should go and try his wings, and he went to Oxford to get his doctor's degree, and he studied under David Martin, a preeminent sociologist of religion at the time, and he came to the conclusion that we evangelicals had undervalued the role of sociology, the psychology of the person, structures of plausibility in our institutions. And so he started writing about the need to be sensitive to those dimensions without at all minimizing truth and doctrine and so forth, but to be aware of the social dimension of human life. And I think he rather changed the way we do apologetics for better, for the good. He started writing about American history. He started writing on how to get along in society with people with whom you differ deeply. And those were issues that Schaefer just didn't address. He was certainly helpful on whenever you could get him going on that, but those are just not areas that he spent much time on. So all I'm saying is that our generation needs to take that passion for truth and then apply it in areas where it's critical to do so. Every generation will have new challenges and we'll need to meet them from a biblical perspective. And nostalgia for Francis Schaefer won't help, but building on his legacy and in a way that he would have appreciated or approved, that's what you need to do.
Yes, I've, at least from my personal life, ministry and teaching, have felt that his view of pre-evangelism and that when we looked at a person in front of us, we first saw a human being, not a sinner. I thought for myself that was extremely profound in terms of its apologetic value.
Couldn't agree more. He would say, to the point where some people criticize him for imprecision, but he would say, we've got to preach truth before we preach the gospel. And what he meant by that is, he didn't mean to be gagged about the gospel, but he meant people can't respond to the gospel until they've got a framework in which it makes sense. Otherwise, they will just take it as one more existential experience. That part of his so-called pre-evangelism, I think, was very insightful. Peter Berger once said, our generation is conversion prone. And if you just preach the gospel, without any background, you might find people responding because they're conversion prone, not because they've repented. So he had a lot of that right, and as you say, he saw people first as image bearers and only second as rebels against God. Mm. And that was one of the attractive things about Labrie, is that all sorts and conditions including me, were welcomed and honored. They took a genuine interest in people. And I remember several conversations where a relatively seemingly simple person or insignificant person would eventually try to ask a question, and you know, he'd give that person all the time in the world and tell them how profound their insights were. And this was just because of his view of human beings as image bearers. So, yeah, that I think has to endure. That's one of the parts of his legacy, which I hope we will always carry forward. Mm-hmm.
We have, if we look at C.S. Lewis, obviously, or at least I think, that C.S. Lewis has endured primarily because of the work of Walter Hooper, who was just tenacious in getting, you know, Lewis's works published and working with publishing houses to get that done. It's a question if it would ever have happened, because in those days, after an author died, nobody really cared much about what he had said. Do you think is there anybody that, or maybe institution that is helping to do the same thing for Schaefer? I don't mean to make him an icon. I mean to keep his ideas in the mix of evangelical conversation.
Yeah, I think you're right that many of the great people have had their mentors who carry forth the legacy. You know, you can think of composers like Messiaen, whose wife, Yvonne Loriot, did that for him. And you can think of plenty of artists whose work is defended by sometimes a family member or sometimes, you know, like in the case of Stravinsky, one of his students became the person who kind of handled his legacy. For Schaefer, there are, I think, people. There's no one person, I don't think, who's just carrying the flame. Lane Dennis at Crossway has done a remarkable job of keeping his memory alive through publications. He's published, you know, a lot of manuscripts that weren't published in his lifetime, or correspondence. Then let's not forget, too, that LaBrie is still alive and well. If I'm not mistaken, there are 10 residential LaBries throughout the world, and they each have their own emphases and culture, but each of them certainly builds on the legacy of Francis Schaefer. So he's kept alive at LaBrie. And then LaBrie-related ministries, such as Christian Heritage in Cambridge, the Francis Schaefer Institute in St. Louis, people who have a burden to carry on his legacy, you know, they're still out there. So I don't know what the next 10, 20 years are going to bring. But I think at this point, there are people that are keeping the flame alive, and let's hope that goes on.
Well, we're trying to do what we can here. This is part of this whole project. I feel quite passionate about it, as does the institution, that it will be to our hurt, the church I'm speaking now in general, evangelical world, it will be to our hurt if we forget the prophetic voice of Francis Schaefer. And I don't mean prophetic and he was going to tell us what the next moment was, but how he could speak prophetically into the reality in which we all had to live. it was something that has struck me, and I think is just absolutely essential to speak into the world today the truth claims of Christianity, and do it in such a way that it connects with the person who is living in that real world.
Right.
So in as I bring this to a close, Bill, is there anything that you would like to say that is we haven't discussed, that I haven't asked the proper question to let you to discuss it? I'm now going to let you kind of chart your own course.
Oh, I think we've covered a lot, Bruce. The essence of the, you know, his connection with reality, you want that for people today. The dual reality of love and truth. You know, I think I work in a theological seminary, and our temptation, I don't say we succumb, is to intellectualize the truth and to assume that if you have a correct doctrinal position, everything is fine. And I think Schaefer would have said, no, truth without love is just as dangerous as love without truth. And then one thing I guess we didn't talk about much is his apologetic method. So Brian has really captured some of that, and others have as well. But for me, he had this uncanny ability to look into someone's heart and see the tension, if you will, between what a person claims and the philosophical basis on which those claims rest, which were, of course, inadequate unless you're in Christ. And sometimes he could find these contradictions in just the thought world, but other times it was the contradiction between a person's position and his life, or some, you know, some habit or whatever it might be. I remember one of Barbara's friends who was up at La Brea and is actually quite a great admirer of Francis Schaefer. Her main objection to Christian faith, if you can believe this, was animal cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
Because she thought the idea of sacrificing lambs and so forth was evil. And one day Schaefer looked down and asked her, why are you wearing leather shoes? And, you know, just he had this amazing ability to find out our contradictions. And these were evident. This is not to mess somebody up. It was evidence of the unsuccessful project of living in God's world without acknowledging him. So I would say that would be a legacy we want to preserve in our apologetics, the ability to see someone's heart and to find, you know, where the idols are and expose them in order to bring the gospel to bear.
I, in reading Schaefer, then of course looking at the Bible that we have, it seems to me that one item in Schaefer's life that must have played a major role in everything that you have said, his ability to look into the human heart, his ability to see contradictions, etc., was from his such a, I don't want to say complete, but it was almost a complete dependence upon the scriptures, but how well informed he was about the scriptures.
Right.
That the scriptures simply informed him at every turn of his life. Would you say that's right?
Oh, absolutely. I remember his sermons. You know, I'd heard a bunch of sermons in my life, but I'd never heard anything quite like this. He would go on for 2 hours, which for a 19-year-old was not a problem. In retrospect, you think of the moms in the room. But anyway, and he would just basically cite verses from Scripture to build his case, and he would pause over them, and he seemed to have access to the whole Bible in every sermon. Even a series like Job or Joshua, which, you know, I sat under, of course he'd start with Job, but he would navigate through all of Scripture, had tremendous knowledge. You know, and he taught Greek and Hebrew, and he was familiar, conversant with the original languages, and he could use the tools that we, you know, that are at our disposal. But yeah, he was very, very, very committed to Scripture, with the, I guess, qualifier that it had to be the Holy Spirit witnessing to Scripture for you to derive the insights from it that are placed there, and not just an encyclopedic knowledge. Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Well, kind of circling back where you started to bring this to a close, it seems to me, and even by his own admission, that his book, True Spirituality, that LaBrie would not have existed without that whole episode in his life and the writing of True Spirituality. It's interesting to me that is not usually a book that people have read. When you say, what books have you read about that Francis Schaeffer wrote, the one that you don't hear very often is True Spirituality. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I agree with you. I've been to a lot of conferences, you know, where people will ask, where do you start with Francis Schaeffer, expecting you to say the God who was there, or maybe how should we then live? And I always say True Spirituality, because he himself said that was his basic book. And it came out of a series of sermons, which he preached several times. I was there for a bunch of them. Where he kind of very creatively and remarkably looked at sanctification with this angle that we've been talking about of reality in mind. And it's just full of insights about human nature, psychology, the true deeper meaning of the commandments, you know, one of the things he says in there is that we have to love God to the place where we don't covet, and we have to love our neighbor to the place where we don't envy them. And then he talks about very subtle ways in which we can covet and envy. I mean, standard stuff in one way, but said so freshly, even with his own vocabulary, in other ways. So you wouldn't want this to replace Calvin or, you know, John Owen. It's not what he's doing. But you'd want to have that book handy, and have the insights in it characterize your life.
Well, Bill, I want to say thank you for our conversation.